So I want to start off by also acknowledging some of the people I work for, or work with, and for. I specifically in the Center for Research on Unexpected Events, it's led by Paul Cohen, and a lot of people at the Information Sciences Institute are part of it. And basically the mission of the center is to work on the foundational mathematics and computer science related issues related to large, complex systems that have some sort of function that is very interwoven into the structure and functioning of the system, and potentially could be threatened, and how might we respond to this, and so forth. So that gives a little bit of the background of where I come from. I'll explain this in a moment. So I'm going to present two things, two simulators. I don't do work in crime simulation. So these come from two different backgrounds of different areas. The HAT simulator is designed for work on terrorist hunting, developing algorithms for doing all the varieties of information munging that you want to do and trying to identify terrorist-related threats. The asymmetric threat assessment tool comes partially from a terrorism a framework, but also a battle space, or more of the insurgent level of kind of scenario. And so I thought I'd start off introducing these by trying to lay out sort of what our philosophy is and the way that we treat the simulations that we build. I don't think that there's anything deep or profound about this picture. So the Venn diagram here describes three possible ways of viewing what a simulator might be used for. There's evaluation, or for training. Evaluation for us means something very specific. We're interested in building environments in which we can take algorithms and really test them out and find out what they're good at and what they're not good at. And simulation can also be used for explanation. We've seen lots of examples of that at this conference. And I think what all of us would really like is if we could also use simulations for prediction. And that really gets at what would be really nice is if we can use simulation for helping us make decisions and to control scenarios so we can have them go the direction we would like them to go. So the HAT simulator, we're primarily using it in this realm for evaluation, maybe to some extent training. I'm not really going to talk about that here. So the idea is that the simulation I'm describing is very abstract. It's not meant to capture any specific terrorist environment scenario. The idea is to instead hopefully capture some of the very general properties that we think any algorithm is going to be put to task in trying to, say, identify a pattern that seems disconcerting or try to track events we'll have to deal with. And then the algorithm would then be set off and put fed real data and be used for decision control. The second simulator I'll be describing does a little bit more on the side of prediction, although again, I'm not making any claims about the models that we are representing in that simulator. It was the product of a seedling project that we did for, I think it was only 4 months, related to effects-based operations. So that's the basic background, and hopefully gives you an idea of, or a good intuition on how to interpret the work that we're doing. So I'll start off by describing the HAT simulator. So the HAT simulator was really born out of events after September 11th. The DoD put out a general call, as well as the intelligence agencies, for any sort of technology that any university might have available. This was actually an official call. And Paul Cohen, who's been my advisor for a long time and colleague, he and Niall Adams dreamt up this idea of what if we had a way of simulating a society in a box, and particularly we want to make it available to the academic community to do research so that you don't have to have a degree in criminology or, in this case, terrorism. You don't have to be working on classified data. You don't have to have specialized domain knowledge, but you can still work on developing algorithms that will hopefully address the kinds of problems that real analysts are worried about. So we want to require little domain knowledge. The other thing is that became apparent was that there, of the data sets that were available, they're very expensive to generate. They either require a lot of very careful cleansing, and the other thing is that they typically are about only the event that you care about. What we're interested in instead is the events you care about are buried in a sea of events that are perfectly benign and that you really don't care about. And so we have, that's what we mean by a very low signal to noise ratio. Another property that we wanted to have this society in the box have was that we wanted it to be able to generate data online so that you get a temporal feed of events, so that you then have to look in and mine that data, figure out, put pieces together as they're unfolding, and then you can then address issues about decision making and some aspects of prediction within the simulator. And we also wanted to have, again, because of the sheer size, force whoever is playing this game or whatever algorithm is tackling this to have to generate and manage a huge number of hypotheses. So the HAT simulator is set up like a game, where the goal is to find terrorist task forces before they can do harm. I'll start by talking about sort of the general architecture of the simulator, because that will highlight some more features. The core simulator is pictured over here. It keeps track of the game state. There's a meeting planner. All the behaviors that take place, all the events that take place, are planned, so they're structured. This was another response to data sets that we saw available, was that typically they were just generated events based on some sort of distribution. We instead wanted there to be potential chains and sequences of events that depended on each other, so that if you start to piece those together, you can use that information to try and target what might be happening. The core simulator also takes care of handling scoring. So the idea is that as you're playing this game, there are a variety of different things that you are scored on, particularly whether or not you're catching a terrorist, but also if you miss a terrorist event, and so forth. I'll say more about that. In the middle, between the analyst and the core simulator, is an information broker. We are assuming that information is very noisy. That's been another theme of this conference, is that even when somebody's not trying to specifically hide information, just in the structure of reporting crimes, there's a lot of noise that's introduced. So we impose, and we can play with a variety of different noise models. And we also are going to keep track of the information that you are requesting from the simulator. So again, the idea is that all the information is kept track in the game state, but it's up to you to ask for it. And furthermore, the more you have to ask for it, we're going to assume that comes at a penalty. Obviously, there are probably certain aspects, certain factions in the CIA that would love to get every piece of information about everybody all the time, but obviously that's not the kind of society you would live. Probably most people would not want to live in that kind of society. So we want the HAT simulator to be sort of a thought experiment in which we can play with, well, how little can we get away with? What are the relative trade-offs? And then finally on the outside, there's the analysts. So I mentioned that the domain model is very simple, so I'm going to describe in the next three slides basically all that you would need to know about to actually play this game. So here we have the basic entities. The basic entities or agents are called HATs. The allusion to the spaghetti western is the idea that in classic spaghetti westerns, you know instantly who the good guys and bad guys are by the color of their hat. So here the problem is everybody wears a gray hat. There may be a few black hats, a few people who you know are known bad guys, as your Bin Laden types. They might be, in the crime suit scenario, might be a well-known gang member. So those are your known terrorists. Most people are benigns. There's an interesting section in here of covert terrorists. I'm not sure how much of a correlation there is of this to crime scenarios, but certainly in terrorism there is a huge issue with this. And the name of the game is to identify who these people are. All individuals in this simulation belong to two or more organizations, where an organization is basically a collection of individuals, and that organization is going to be responsible for directing their actions. Organizations are very abstract in the HAT simulator, but you can think of them as anything from where you work to where you go go shopping. You know, the fact that all these people in the neighborhood go shopping in the same place makes them part of an organization. Anything that will shape group behavior. All individuals, all these hats, have attributes or capabilities. Again, it's very abstract in the hat simulator. They're just Jensen tokens. But the idea is that these attributes allow you to do things. And in particular, in the simulation, it's simulated on a large 2D grid. There are beacons, points of interest, that you would like to defend. And the beacons have vulnerabilities. And if hats carrying the correct combination of capabilities and their terrorists bring those capabilities to one of those beacons, then the beacon will be attacked. So already you can see there's some information in here that you might want to be using to track and decide what's a threat. You want to see what is somebody carrying, where are they approaching someplace that we care about. So those are all the entities in the environment, in the simulation. The primary events that occur are meetings. Meetings happen when a set of hats get together and they meet in one place for some small amount of time. Otherwise, they're just moving around almost randomly. Well, they're directed, but certainly when you look at it, it looks random in this 2D grid. Meetings take place because of tasks. So the idea is that every once in a while, an organization will say, I'm going to plan a task. The first thing the organization will do is I want to get some set of my hats in my organization to carry a certain set of attributes to some target location. That's what defines a task. Meetings are then how attributes will be traded amongst individuals so that they can accomplish what they want to do. And then finally, attacks are the rare events that occur when a meeting of terrorists meets at a beacon and they happen to be carrying the capabilities that match the vulnerabilities of that beacon. Then an attack occurs. And I mentioned metrics and scores. There's the information broker, which is keeping track of how much information you pay for. One possible variation on this would be to make certain information cost more than other information, but more than that. So the scoring is how much information you paid, false positives, which means if you were to accuse a benign hack of something that they haven't done, that's going to be a penalty, and certainly losing a beacon to an attack is going to be very costly. And so this turns the hat simulation game into one in which you want to minimize your costs. So obviously, I've sort of touched on the fact that players playing this game have actions they can take. They can pay for information. They can arrest hats. An arrest will only be successful if the hat happens to be a terrorist and that hat is currently part of a terrorist task force. This is a critical distinction. There might be other models that one might want to play with, but the idea here is that, look, somebody might be part of a bad organization, but unless they're really doing something that's bad, you have due cause for arresting them, you're going to incur a cost. And finally, another action that the player can take is they can raise beacon alert levels. The reason why we added this is the idea that you may not know exactly what's going to happen, but you might have enough information to say, I think that this area might be threatened. And then the idea is you can raise an alert, and if the alert is raised at a beacon when the attack is attempted, then the consequences are not as bad. So that in a nutshell, this slide and the previous two basically sums up everything that happens inside HACS. I'm going to say a little bit more about terrorist plans, because to us this is an important component of the simulation. By the way, I haven't said anything about size. We're talking simulations on the order of 100,000 individuals up to millions. We, so far, have only gone up to millions. We have actually been working with a group to extend this to potentially up to a billion individuals. All the behavior of these individuals is structured. So I'm going to step through now how a plan that sets in motion these behaviors gets set up and what those behaviors look like. So the idea is that these ovals here are just schematic representations of organizations. All hats are members of at least two organizations, so there's a lot of overlap. Here I've only drawn two. But let's suppose this organization is a terrorist organization. And just to help things, I've labeled some of these individuals with numbers. So the first thing that an organization will do is choose some subset of its individuals, and this becomes the task force, and these are the individuals that it's going to say, go do something.
I'm sorry, yeah. I'm confused.
Yeah.
The orange ovals are individuals?
Yes.
And,
that's right.
And, oh, I see. And then,
this is all an organization. That's right. This has no spatial representation at all. It's just schematically. That's right. And you can see, HAT 91, who happens to be in this task force, is a part of two organizations. By the way, anybody can ask questions at any time. Feel free to interrupt. So the next step in planning a set of behaviors or a task is the organization will select some target location. In this case, the terrorist organization happens to have chosen a beacon. But in the general running of the game, it doesn't necessarily have to be a beacon. It could be some other random location. I've colored, these colors here are to schematically represent the vulnerabilities of the beacon. And then I've added colors to capabilities that these individuals happen to be carrying when the task was originally planned. So we see that the task force right now does carry this capability of matching one of the vulnerabilities, but these other two are not currently carried by the task force. So the planner then says, okay, who else in my organization has those capabilities, and how am I going to get them to them? And to do that, then meetings are planned. So in this case, this box here represents that there's going to be a meeting at some time later that these three hats are going to get together, and then this capability, the red capability, is going to be traded to this hat 37 from hat 17. Turns out that hat 17 also still has that capability and goes off and does something else. More meetings are planned until finally the planner has set up a tree or some sort of graphical structure of meetings to take place in the future that will eventually get all the capabilities to that task force. The task force then goes to the target, and because this is a terrorist organization playing this and the target is a beacon, they will attempt to attack that beacon. So that's what happens in an attack, or in a plan that happens to result in an attack. Here are some examples of some of the structured meeting trees that are created by this planning process. These just have names of individual hats, what beacon they're targeting. The number here is just an idea of the meeting that's going to take place. And so these are meant to be read inversely. The idea is this is the final event. You'll start off with a series of meetings that are taking place at the leaves, and eventually individuals from these meetings will go on and meet with each other and so forth and do some trades until eventually the capabilities are in the hands of the task force.
Sorry, can I ask that?
Yeah.
So the capability is sort of a 0-1 value?
They're tokens. So they're some ID. So I can have capability type 3.
Yeah, but you can't have some degree of capability.
No, right? No, you're absolutely right about that. That's very discrete. And again, think about capabilities as representing roughly things, everything from maybe somebody is giving you orders to go to a particular place. That might be what one of these represents. Or it could be a particular material, like bomb-making material. It could be information about maps for a building and so forth. Again, the reason why we chose this very abstract representation is because from what we are told of what analysts track, they do pick up properties or attributes of individuals based on communication events or where they've gone and so forth. And again, also, this is all at the ground truth level, the way I'm describing it here. The access of the analyst to this is through very spotty information. I can say, what capability are you carrying now? And that has a certain cost. But then, as time goes on, a wrinkle I haven't mentioned yet is that capabilities will eventually expire. So there's going to have to be a lot of inference about, is that person still carrying that capability? Or, oh, I saw these guys get together. Does that mean a trade took place? There's a lot of inferencing that has to go on to play the game.
Capabilities expire regardless of trading and meetings?
Yes. So one of the one of the subtleties, which I haven't mentioned, is that the way the simulator is set up right now is that capabilities are traded all the time in meetings. But if it's for one of these planned meetings that eventually arrives at that's meant to get a capability to a target, That's not going to expire in the way that we've set it up right now. We've talked about variation. There's many variations, what directions we can go in. One is that we could say that they might even expire if it's meant to go to that target, in which case replanning might take place. Right now, it's sort of, the plan is set at the beginning, and then it just goes, and if some, you know, if the analyst were to arrest one of those hats, that plan won't work anymore. Whereas in the real world, there's going to be lots of responses.
Get killed in an automobile.
Exactly.
Or something. Okay.
Yeah.
You have noise, extra information in this, but I wonder, is it set up so that the complete tree is there for them to find, or in the
yes.
real world, it's not there? There's holes in the information, so they don't have the complete trees.
This is what's happening in the core simulator. It's up to the analyst to infer whether that's there.
So they can't get it by asking a question. They
purchase. Not the way we've set it up right now. The framework.
Because the real world, they don't have all
exactly.
Okay.
It in the framework is meant to be very adjustable. So in the information worker, which was that box that stood between the analyst and the,
yeah.
and the environment, there's an interface that basically says you can ask these questions. So some of the questions are: what capability are you carrying right now? Where are you? Have you been in a meeting? If you were in that meeting, who else was there? That's
but
basically.
The knowledge broker doesn't necessarily have the complete information. That's my question.
Well, the knowledge, okay, so in the code, the knowledge broker does have it, but there's a noise model that's inserted in between so that if you ask a question, depending on how much you pay for it, you're going to get back a certain quality of information about that ground truth.
But in reality, the knowledge broker doesn't have that information.
Well, we're assuming.
You have to infer.
Yes, yes, yeah, yeah, very much so. I mean, there are actual events that take place,
yeah.
then there's our perception of them.
Right.
Or, yeah.
So you don't require the people doing this to come up with filling in the parts of the tree that aren't there.
Oh, they have to. Yeah, that's
the knowledge. The knowledge broker is existential.
Yes.
Not an entity.
Yeah.
No, I understand that. It's just if they were to continue to ask, you have all the knowledge there. So if they were to ask the right question.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking for a minimal number of questions, assuming that knowledge is
certainly
is existentially knowable.
Right.
A finite number of questions.
That's right.
Okay.
Now, there's another wrinkle to this, too, which is the time dependency of information. One of the noise models that we played with a while back, we looked at if you were to ask that last week versus now, you're going to get different answers or different quality of answers. Just as people's memories get foggy. I mean, the idea is the information broker could be thought of as an information source. Like, I've got my guy I can go and ask a question of. I'm going to pay him some information to get it. Or the information broker could be thought of just in general. I've got my sensor network that goes in and gathers information. Maybe it's cameras from a, you know, security cameras, something like that. But it's a, again, meant to abstractly capture. This is your, as the analyst, this is how you might look into what's actually going on, but it's very fuzzy and it depends on how much resources you apply to it.
But all is knowable.
Not only by what you define as that interface.
Okay.
So if it's available, then yes, I can ask you, what capability are you carrying? Yeah. Well, no, this is actually worth spending some time on. One of the aspects of it is of the noise model, and again, it depends on what kind of noise model you use. It could be that just because of the particular kind of information you're asking for might be so noisy that it's basically impossible for you to actually get that specific piece of information. That can happen. Okay. Right, so here's the space of possible hypotheses that the analyst is going to have to deal with. Sort of at the base, sort of ground level, this is information you can pretty much ask directly about. Things like the locations of an individual hat, what capabilities they're carrying. Intent, actually, you cannot ask. And I've put these in bold black, the things that you can ask for. Meetings, you can also ask some targeted information about. Did a capability trade take place? Who were the other members in that meeting? But you could also infer that as aggregate information out of this other information. You could say, well, these guys met. All these guys were sitting on that location for some amount of time and then dispersed. Well, that was probably a meeting. As you go up, though, things become much more based on inference. So what the task forces are, and also the general groups supporting them, that's something that has to be completely inferred. So there's a hypothesis about what's the group of hats, what are the locations of those group members, what is that group, all the individual members carrying as far as at the current time tech, as well as what is their intent. And then finally, there's at the organization level, who are the general organization members, and is an organization benign or malevolent? And there's a lot of feedback that goes up and down here. So if, after you're playing this for a while, you begin to gather information and you think that this set of hats seems to be all part of a group, a big portion of them have been involved in bad activity in the past, I see all these other guys implicated with them, I'm going to start suspecting, well, maybe they also have bad intent, and I'm going to want to look closer at what they're doing. And that feeds back down. If I've identified a group and I see, oh, these guys are all members of a bad organization, I'm going to start paying attention more to that group and what it's doing. So, of course, the ultimate target hypothesis here is whether a beacon is threatened and when that might happen. Notice also that hypotheses take place at different timescales. Information here has, information in general has a certain life cycle. Here, locations change from tick to tick. Roughly every 25 ticks, capabilities are going to either expire or might change hands, or you might acquire new ones. So while you ask for the capabilities of a hat at a certain time, for a while afterwards, you're going to have a pretty good idea that they probably still are carrying that, but after a long period of time, you're going to have to do some more information gathering or do some other inference to make sure that they really have that. At roughly 150 ticks is about, depending on what parameters you set, how often beacon attacks occur, as well as how often plans are created. And then finally, there are certain things that last, at least in our little scenarios that we run, for the duration, like what the group intent and intent of individuals are according to what organization they belong to.
And typically, how many ticks is the duration?
Of a simulation?
Yeah.
That really varies. I mean, if we're interested in just a specific targeted example that we want to analyze closely and how an algorithm does, it's 150 ticks to 200. But we've run it for 10,000 ticks. And the reason to do that is to get lots of data so that you can accumulatively look at how you perform. So this is a snapshot. We have a GUI, which is darn near useless. but the point here is to say, look, looking at this, you're not going to be able to tell what's going on. Just as if you really could look down on a city, you're not going to be able to tell. You have to use some other way of structuring the information so that you can make sense out of it. There are some little things to point out. These green boxes, here, these are the actual beacons. They're a little bit hard to pick out. All these hats, if I had a closer picture, you'd actually be able to see. The hats are colored because this is meant to be a grand truth representation, just so you could see how things are moving around.
Can I just ask, the co-red hats?
Yes.
The analyst is making an assumption that there is a hat that has perhaps certain skill sets that might be associated with the meeting.
Right.
You don't know they exist.
Right.
Is that right? But the analyst might insert somebody because the assumption is that they need someone with certain skill sets.
Yes.
And then by association, there may be another group through links that hat might be associated with.
That's right.
When you look at that, obviously, it's very difficult to interpret.
Yeah.
How do they manage, because there may be tens of thousands of these covert hats in the simulation.
Yeah.
How do they manage updating that information when they identify a specific member of the group that may or may not be associated with all the other groups that hat is associated with?
Right. So something I'll get to, my main focus in this presentation was to show you the simulation technology, why we made the decisions we did, and so forth. I'll mention very briefly in one slide some of the technology we're using to try and do some tracking. The reason why I didn't think it was as relevant here is because, again, it's not clear to me how similar terrorism is to crime. I mean, there's very interesting similarities, but also some very distinct differences. The way we're doing is we're looking at doing probabilistic graphical modeling that is temporally based, so things like dynamic Bayes nets. So basically, one of the big issues is the complexity and the combinatorial explosion of different combinations of hypotheses. But as far as the updating goes, the idea is that your next cycle, you get some information, use your previous state of knowledge, and use a Bayesian updating rule to combine the two and probabilistically then say, this is my new belief state. And that's just one approach. Other approaches to this problem, I know that groups like Metron and 21st Century do some pattern identification. So they do some spiffy analysis to say, well, we think that, you know, this kind of pattern is going to be very important. So what they do is then they collect a set of data and then they sweep the pattern over and see if they find an instance, and then they focus, you know, focus search on that. There's all kinds of different ways of tackling this. Again, this is exactly what we wanted to have happen from a scenario like this. But one of the big challenges is, how do you manage huge amounts of hypotheses? Our approach has been to go probabilistic, because you can summarize lots of data with probabilities, but there are certainly other ways. I was gonna throw caution to the wind and actually try and run this. The reason why I'm running this is I can show you some of the other things that we've been doing. Let's see how this works. Okay, so this is the actual simple version of the simulator. It's a very small scenario. I think there's like 300 individuals and lots of beacons. So one of the things that we were interested in doing using the simulator was to study something that's called suspicion scoring. So the idea is, if you know some seed individuals that are bad, just look at the associations, who they associate with, and what frequency. And so a very simple abstract model is something we call perjury. And it's basically a kind of bucket model where certain individuals, which are the black hats, have they have a suspicion of one. Okay, we know that they're bad guys. Anytime that they meet, we see a beacon, there was an attack there, and you saw there was actually one of these red beams was one of the suspicious hats. Anytime they meet with another hat, it increases their perjury score. But then over time, if they don't meet with anybody, their score will gradually go down. And so you've got this kind of propagation model. And one of the guys in our group, Aram Galstein, who's a statistical physicist, did some really nice work on looking at the relationships between individuals. So you can think of it as a graph evolving over time, and look at propagating suspicion scoring. And he found that it's very sensitive to the, if you're gonna say, I'm gonna say you're suspicious because you're above some threshold, it's very sensitive to what threshold you set. On the other hand, if you look at the dynamics of the spread, it turns out there's this really interesting property where if you have a bad organization and you have a seed member, and you, or actually any organization, and you spread out in this graph the suspicion, it'll spread at a certain rate pretty rapidly and then slow down, and then suddenly explode and everybody's implicated. And it's that kind of signature that turns out to be very indicative of a group boundary. Again, this is the kind of thing we were wanting to use this kind of framework for getting at, and that's turned out to be very useful for a lot of the ways that we've been thinking about how we're gonna find groups. And again, remember, there's all kinds of different facets, even in this simple model. There's who are the groups, what are they carrying, what are their capabilities, and where are they? Are they getting closer to a beacon or not? Actually, on the point of space, space is very abstracted here. And certainly, one thing I've walked away from this meeting is that geography, there's huge amounts of information in geography. It particularly looks like very relevant to crime, as far as where crime is located. Here, space really only begins to matter near the end of a planned attack, when finally people are converging on a beacon. Other than that, people basically randomly meet and walk around. So I wouldn't want somebody to be misled into thinking that was that we were trying to model space. So I'm going to move on from this. So going back to hats, I don't like markers. Okay. So this is just to give you some idea of the amount of data that's generated. I guess focus on these red lines given the time. So if I run 100,000 hats, and I were to look at the relationships between them in terms of a meeting graph, then the graph would have roughly 100,000 vertices notice is a little bit higher. One of the details I didn't mention is that hats could actually enter the game, and hats also leave the game. The reason to do that kind of turnover is that if it was a completely closed system, after a certain amount of time, you're going to be able to very easily figure out who's a part of what. So we wanted to have some turnover. But aside from that, run for 1,000 ticks, we get roughly 7 million edges, or 7 million relations. Running 500,000 hats, we end up with, run for 500 ticks, we end up with 27 million edges. So we are able to generate huge amounts of data. It's been very useful for looking at the algorithms that we've been analyzing. Let's skip over the implementation. You mentioned what are we doing to try and solve this problem. Our group has been looking in terms of, we've been looking at plan identification literature in AI, and the sort of state of the art is to consider hierarchical task networks, where the idea is that you break down tasks according to sort of intended effects at a global level and then to more fine-grained level. So in general, you have a general attack that's going to be planned, but that is broken down to a series of steps which are further broken down. Eventually, you get to the point where these are things that we might be able to measure. So for example, I see that there's a meeting that takes place at this location, another meeting. I could begin to maybe eventually reconstruct that meeting tree. But it's an inference going back up then to identify what the target is, who's doing the attack, and so forth. And we've been using dynamic Bayes nets. That's been our chosen methodology, but there are plenty other approaches. So that pretty much ends the portion on hats. So that's one approach to doing simulation and how we've been using it. Some of the other work which we did, and this goes back about 4 years or so, around the time that I had joined the group, we've been doing a bit of work on battle space modeling. And so what we did is we had built a simulator which has in it a lot of rules about how abstractly force-on-force battles take place. We have a terrain model, so here's a little bit more of a representation of space and its effects on what's going on. And one of the great advantages of doing simulation like this is that computing power is still relatively cheap, as long as you're not running something too expensive on it. And you can do Monte Carlo simulation, where basically you say, I know the basic scenario, I know roughly the players involved. Now what I'm going to do is do some little variations on the starting position, mass ratios, and so forth, and run it, see what happens at the end, and do it again, and do it over and over and over and over again. And this was a nice example of one of the things we were able to do with Monte Carlo simulation, where given a scenario that a commander might be faced with, maybe they can run in 15 minutes or so a quick set of Monte Carlo simulations and see that, well, I find that, you know, each one of these paths through this space here, where the space here, this dimension is time, this is a variable that we identified called mass near the action, which basically means if I'm in a battle space, I see there's where my opponent is, I'm going to measure just how much of my mass do I have right in the center of what he's doing. And what it was found was for this scenario, there's a critical point here, which is about the time when I am actually within contact and can start firing on him. Roughly, things below this point tend to result in bad outcomes for me, as red lines. Whereas if I tend to be above this point, in this area, I'm going to generally do okay. What's good about this information is that's something actionable. That says, okay, I'm going to make sure that I get my mass to him by a certain amount of time and make sure it's at a certain level, and then I'll be okay. And if while I'm executing that, I see that things are not going my way, I better pull out, because otherwise, with pretty high probability, I'm going to be in trouble. This is very nice. It's completely open question whether anything like this might be able to be done for kinds of scenarios that one might care about in tactical, crime fighting. What we have done is we've started to look at how we might use that in scenarios more towards the realm of insurgency, which begins to incorporate aspects of terrorism and aspects of crime. And so enter this next tool that we developed called the asymmetric threat assessment tool. The basic idea here, this comes from, there's a school of thought in the Department of Defense that's interested in something called effects-based operations. And the idea is that, okay, so classical military battles, you basically think of how big am I, how big are they, where do I send my guys and wipe them out. And here the idea is to then broaden the context and think about, okay, if I'm going to, say, go into an area that's populated with people, I'm going to have to take into consideration, you know, the people that aren't directly involved in the conflict. Not only do I not want to hurt them, but I also care about what they're thinking and what they might offer as far as support and information to me, as well as how they might give away opponents, or they might eventually turn against me depending on what I do. There's also other issues. There's the infrastructure of the city that I'm going into. How do I treat that? How does that affect the particular people that I'm interested in shutting down? How does that affect also in a general populace the possibility of insurgency showing up there? They use a model that they call a Panizzi model. There are all a bunch of different kinds of psychological models. The belief, desire, intention is another one that was mentioned. Panizzi breaks down looking at a populated region in terms of political, military, economic, social infrastructure, and information factors. And so the idea is we were interested in, well, what if we were to try to build a simulator using simulation tools that would model some aspects of these things, and how might we use that as a tool to then do some sort of planning? So in the asymmetric threat assessment tool, we took the basic idea from HATS that you've got this generic grid that individuals can move on in space. And the idea that we can then talk about locations, but we'll actually make the geography and region around the locations matter more. And then we also add in some other complexity where we could have resource centers like factories or grocery stores or food sources. And those are linked to each other. Then the individual HATS now get information or get resources and make use of them. Also, there are a variety of different kinds of relationships between individuals, acquaintances, trust relationships, which are a bit stronger. There might also be enemies, two people are enemies of each other, and represent those, again, abstractly in this sort of graphical framework, graph-based framework. But the idea is you've got multiple layers of different kinds of interacting effects. And in this case, we explicitly have these different Panizzi measures. So each individual will actually have an index or a vector of Panizzi measures, but then how they're related and updated dependent on their relationship to others. And so what we did, it so happens that the map that was used was for Northern California, so we've got, and the border of Oregon, so you've got Medford up there and a variety of other places. But the idea was that here we've got population centers now. Remember in HATS, everybody moved around everywhere. Now people are concentrated. Each actor has a role or multiple roles. So they go, if they work at a factory, they will tend to go around that area. Of course, that will change if you took that factory away. Now what are they going to do? And that's going to have other downstream effects on other properties they have. And then events are going to take place in the simulation. Some of these events will be planned. These yellow dots, they might be, say, a military operation, or say, you know, you are deciding you're going to try and take out some suspected terrorist cell. That's going to have implications for or effects on the people around them. There's also going to be events that will show up as a result of opportunities. So an opportunity is something that is opened up based on some action you take. The reason why we wanted to model those is that, again, thinking in terms of modeling a complex organization or a complex system, the idea is that certain actions you take are going to have effects, including the one that you like and ones that you don't like. Some of those effects that you don't like might be considered opportunities for somebody else to exploit. So initially, you might have a perfectly happy, stable, equilibrium system. You go in and you take out a factory. That's now suddenly going to introduce the opportunity for other actors, depending on what Panizzi levels they're at, to decide to make their own actions. So initially they might have been perfectly happy, but if they have a propensity to want to fight you, and you go in and take out their factory, which adds some instability, now suddenly they're doing actions that before they weren't doing. And that was something that we wanted to capture in the model. So what was the whole purpose of this? The reason why we had, why we built this prototype was the vision for this program was that we wanted to provide a tool that analysts could use so that they were given basically a set of templates that they could fill out, and then that would be instantiated in the model, and then they can use the model to simulate possible outcomes, again, following the idea of the battle space modeling, and be able to look at potential courses of action that they might take and see what happens. So here's an example of, they call this simulation tuning. So one of the things you could do is you could look at, given your best knowledge of how you think these population centers behave and what their relationships are, you could then look at, well, what might happen optimistically in terms of my course of action. You can look at the possible outcomes using a Monte Carlo simulation. You can also consider what are the pessimistic view of what might happen. What's the worst case or near worst case? In this case, you have a bunch of insurgent uprising occurring in different places in Northern California, which we all know is a big threat. So again, it's this idea of getting closer to prediction. I don't want to commit to saying this is clear prediction because it all depends on how much what the quality of the information is that you put into it. And, you know, that's a huge issue. But I think I'll stop there.